The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, folks, we're going to start up again with our second and then third panel. And this is the panel that has the difficult job of focusing on the remaining provisions of the 2007 amendments beyond the archives one, and especially with an emphasis on those that are of particular concern to media organizations. They played a very large role in pressing for these amendments, to be sure. And we have some really solid media folks here with a lot of experience. And speaking of the word experience, let me introduce first, we have Pete Weitzel, who's the coordinator of the CJOG, CJOG for short, which is the Coalition of Journalists for Open Government. And Pete came up here from Florida to do that sort of as a retirement gig, perhaps, much the same as this is a retirement gig for me here as a member of the faculty at the Washington College of Law and heading up the Collaboration on Government Secrecy, because Pete was managing editor of the Miami Herald for many years. And he has become one of the major moving forces for openness in government since CJOG was created about 4 years ago. 4 years ago. And then to his right is Lauren Cochran, who's with an organization that many of you have heard of, the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. Lauren is the coordinator of their FOIA Services Division, FOIA Freedom of Information operation, where they have a hotline and they receive the counterpart calls to the hotline calls that come to the Justice Department. Thousands a year where reporters will call in and complain about agencies and what they're doing and what they're not doing under the FOIA. And then down to Lauren's right is Kevin Goldberg. And Kevin is someone who's been working in this area very actively for more than a dozen years now. He's counsel to the American Society of Newspaper Editors, and he's very well experienced in the legislative process and in media efforts to encourage, if that's a good word, agencies to do the right thing, not the wrong thing under the FOIA. Kevin's now with the law firm of Fletcher, Heald & Hildreth in Arlington. And he has been someone who's been speaking at many of these programs for a good long time and has a real good base of knowledge in this area. So I'm going to leave it to these three gentlemen to cover the remaining parts of the 2007 FOIA amendments, but I'm going to throw out just a general opening question to start it off as to which provision do you think is the most significant or has potentially the greatest long-range impact. Who wants to handle that to start? Pardon?
I'll start. The one we just talked about. I think it has the most potential. I don't know that the potential will ever be realized, but I certainly think it has the most potential to do good on a daily basis and affect change.
Go ahead.
You know, I would just say that immediately, because admittedly, OGIS right now, right now it's amorphous and we're not exactly sure what that will end up looking like. But immediately, I would say the assurance fee provision will be the most significant. And you'll see the most immediate impact.
I think I'd probably disagree with Lauren, and I agree with both Kevin and Lauren on the ombudsman, which is what we call it. I'm not sure that the attorney's fees will wind up being all that important when it actually plays out. In fact,
he's questioning you, not me.
I don't.
It's consistent with, as we'll see, this is consistent with what Pete said all along.
But the one I would simply point to, because Dan put it way down on his list of importance, are the reporting requirements and the fact that there will finally be some data out there that we can look at and get a really good sense of how well the agencies and the components in each of the agencies are performing on FOIA and whether the delays are really continuing, and will we see the turnaround in performance or not, and the fact that we'll be able to get at that raw data and analyze it, manipulate it, to do the kind of cross-tabulations that give you a good sense of what the performance really is. I think that's a major step forward.
How about your feelings about the other provisions of the law, just generally? I know, Pete, did you work it out that you were going to start first?
No, actually, it was.
I'm going to start with just talking about the prohibitions on charging fees.
Lauren, I think you just have to tap your mic so that it turns green on the top.
You can't tell I worked in television for a
there
decade.
You go.
There we go. I'm going to start by talking about the prohibition on charging fees and tell you the backstory behind this. Very frankly, with a lot of your mainstream media, I don't know that this is going to have that much of an effect because they routinely request there to be some sort of a fee waiver or at very least a fee benefit. And I don't imagine that that will change greatly. But what was in here before, what was previously suggested in earlier drafts of the bill, was something much more dramatic and caused the ire of FOIA processors to the point where that was changed. And that was to specifically make exemptions inapplicable if the time limits were not met, so that an agency could not come in and say, well, there's a decisional privilege in there, that there's some sort of, that there's a high two or a low two when we're dealing with exemption two in intra-office policies. There were some very specific measures to try and take the discretion out of those exemptions when the time limits were missed, which I think would have had amazing teeth, but I also realize that a lot of these exemptions don't necessarily lie with the agency. Some of these are personal to the individual who is the subject of the records, and that became a firestorm of controversy and was changed to this taking away the charging of search fees. But there, the...
So the fee provision was a fallback to something that would have been more onerous for agencies.
That's right, and it actually appeared in a House version of the bill, and I think was a good compromise, because I just very frankly don't think taking away the exceptions from the agency would have worked. It would have, I don't think it would have ever been palatable with anyone. But I will say, Pete pointed this out to me yesterday, that the search fee provision, Senator Kyle on the floor talked about this being basically a codification of agency practice as it is, incorporating both unusual circumstances and exceptional circumstances into even more so in the law, and having that be a reason that the agency won't have to avoid charging search fees or duplication fees when it comes to other requesters.
I think one of the curious things that happened in the process, and I don't think it was intentional, but because of the House concern about having to meet their PAYGO provisions and the way they were going to fund this, they provided that all of the money now that is paid out in legal fees is going to have to come from the agency itself. Previously, that was taken from the judgment fund, which is a general governmental fund. And they're not just talking about whatever additional money this provision may require, but now, the way it's written, it's all the money. So this will cover the money that would be paid in legal fees, attorney's costs, where the government loses or where there's a stipulated dismissal, which is what the Buchanan fix was intended to deal with.
D- Have you noticed that in some places on the blogosphere where FOIA plays rather heavily and matters pertaining to the 2007 amendments resonate pretty broadly, it's been suggested that Congress intended to have that funding change to say that attorney's fees no longer come out of the general fund but come out of individual agency appropriations as a means of penalizing agencies. But in fact, that's not the case. It was merely the result of this PAYGO funding rule complication, so to speak, in the House that required that last-minute change. There was no intention to penalize agencies and have it be directed toward them in particular. Now, the effect might be that, but that's not the intention.
And if you'll recall, the Senate tried very hard to avoid putting that PAYGO provision in, and in their original bill, 849, it was not included. So, yeah, it was strictly a matter of trying to come up with a compromise at the end to deal with the House insistence on PAYGO provision.
And the interesting issue that just came up with our FOI listserv yesterday was the idea that many litigators fear that money coming straight from an agency budget will be that much more difficult to collect when attorney's fees are awarded, or even prior to awarding, if there's no specific judicial order on that, if they're trying to negotiate some sort of a settlement. Now, instead of being able to go to a judgment fund, which was not overseen by the agency and didn't have a direct effect on the agency, now they've got to figure out, you know, where that money is going to come from in the agency. So there's definitely accountability in the provision as it is, but I do understand the difficulty and frustration with the idea that now an agency may balk at readily paying attorney's fees.
What about fees of a different type, where it is really a penalty? We're talking about the search and duplication fees. Kevin, do you think that there's a large potential for FOIA requesters, especially favored requesters, so to speak, news media representatives in particular, making requests in the future, having agencies miss a deadline, and then arguing very forcefully that there should be no copying fee in addition to no search fee? Do you see a lot of activity in that area? It doesn't take effect until the end of this year, but do you think that there'll be media requesters who will be looking forward to not having to pay duplication fees under those circumstances?
Well, I certainly hope they do. I think they
will. Do you look forward to it or do pay?
That they look forward to using this provision to their advantage, because this bill is something, or this law now, that's nice to say, this law is something that is intended to affect change. And unless we push the limits as much as we can, change won't occur.
If I can say, your point, Dan, on your outline that talks about if this applies even to commercial, or the fact that it does apply to commercial, I think will be the most interesting thing to develop. As some of Pete's studies have shown, far and away, commercial requesters are your largest requesters. And we're talking about media requesters. We're only talking about 6% of all of the requests that come in are from individuals that identify themselves as working with the media. So that's when we're talking about search fees and even more so copy fees, that's a tiny number compared to your commercial requesters who are doing so much of the requesting.
So it's not just the penalty with respect to duplication fees for media and other favored requesters. It's the new penalty with respect to search fees, even for commercial requesters, because all requesters are covered by that. That's the major change, isn't it?
It is.
Yes. What about the contractor provision? Does anyone quite know what that means and what it might apply to and how it might work?
Well, I don't know what it means. the language is interesting. You know, in all of the discussions and all of the conversations, it was described as dealing with simply the contracting out of management services for handling the handling of records. Leahy said that in a statement on the floor. Clarifies that this applies to agency records held by outside contractors, no matter where they're located. Now, that's a little bit ambiguous, but the House bill report said it clarifies that agency records kept by private contractors licensed by the government to undertake record-keeping functions. So that seems fairly specific. But the language certainly doesn't say that. The language is ambiguous.
You know that the House bill, pardon me, the House report was issued back on
In March.
That didn't go through, language was even changed after the House report.
Right. It was
a matter of statutory construction. That is a very large question as to whether that House report language even applies.
Well, from our perspective, though, Dan, this was one area where I think we actually didn't overreach or even attempt to overreach. To us, at least the members of the Sunshine and Government Initiative, it seemed pretty clear that this was supposed to apply simply to the situation where the records are no longer in the physical possession of the government. It was to codify what we always understood but couldn't really point to it long.
But Section A of that provision says, you know, any information
right.
that would be an agency record subject to the requirements of the section when maintained in agency format, including electronic format. So it really seems to be saying if it's a government record or if the agency is performing, or if the contractor is performing a government function, then the record is a government record. And that's very similar to laws in a number of the states dealing with how you deal with records that are being held by contractors. So I think there's a legitimate question, and I'm absolutely certain it's going to get litigated.
Do you think it might possibly apply to records that are created as a result of an outsourcing process under OMB Circular A76?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think it well could.
Because I'm looking at a report on the blogosphere, and again, this is not anything that's necessarily authoritative, but there's an organization called the Citizen Media Law Project that says that it now applies the view of this organization to government contracting information held by private contractors. And this is a project that's part of the Berkman Center at Harvard Law School. So it carries a little bit more weight, at least in academia, than it otherwise might. I'm seeing another published report that says it applies to private government contractors very broadly. So there is a basis for questioning just where that would apply.
It's a very logical and valid presumption. And while we didn't push for it, the interpretation, I think, is a reasonable one. If an agency contracts out a function it has as a government function to a private entity, then that information about the performance of that function should be public record.
And based on the calls that I take at the Reporters Committee, this may become a very important provision as more and more things are contracted out and more of the records seem to be ending up in contractors' hands and become difficult for media requesters to get those records.
Just by way of background, before this law was enacted, we did have a lot of government functions contracted out or outsourced, so to speak. And I can tell you from my experience at the Justice Department heading OIP for more than 25 years, during that time, I can't remember a single controversy coming up where someone made a FOIA request for records that were maintained by an A76 contractor. It looks as if FOIA requesters, in general, never pressed that point previously, but now they have a very concrete legislative basis for doing so. How about bloggers? There's another term. Are bloggers now, quote, unquote? I've got an article here that is dated January 3rd, and it says, "Bloggers rejoice. We're now covered by the Freedom of Information Act." Is that entirely true? Is it partly true, or is it not true at all? What do you gentlemen think?
I would
say
it's partly true. When Senator Cornyn was initially drafting the open government bill, and there was a lot of conversation with people in the requester community, I know that we and obviously many other people talked with his staff at the time. And one of the concerns we had was this whole area of the bloggers, the blogosphere, and what happens with them under the Freedom of Information Act, and clearly a need to expand the definition of a journalist or the news media to include the changes that were happening in both in our society with the internet and within the news industry itself. So the original language said there ought to be a publication history, and you could base your the agencies could base their decision on who should be granted a waiver based on publication history, and then they added the intent to publish if they did not have a publication history, because many of these people who were getting on the blog had an intent to do it. They simply didn't have a record of some kind that they could point to. And to then an intent to publish to a reasonably broad audience. And that language stayed in the bill until Senator Kyle offered his objections, and there was then a compromise and a change in the wording to what we have now. The interesting thing, I think, is why Senator Kyle raised the objections, and he obviously had been talking at length with the Justice Department about concerns they had. And the stated reason, at least, was that, you know, the news media, the people in the news media want something fast. They've got some kind of a deadline they're working on. Maybe they'll even meet their deadlines once in a while. And so they're going to file a fairly narrow and specific request for information because they want it in a hurry and they don't want it to drag on. So that rarely did complex and vague requests come in from media requesters. But other people, and they were including here in their expressed concerns, out there in the blogosphere, the bloggers, would just ask for everything and make very broad and vague requests. And so they acknowledged, and Senator Kyle acknowledged in his comments on the floor of the Senate, that one of the reasons the agencies were opposed to this provision is that they use this media waiver as a means to control the request and to be able to go back to the requesters and to get them to narrow the request and clarify it. And that this is essentially a control mechanism of the agencies. You say it really had nothing to do with the media. It was they identified non-media requesters as those most likely to come in with difficult and voluminous requests, and so this was a means to control it. And that was really the basis for his raising objection and then it ultimately leading to the compromise.
Well, there was another aspect of that where I believe it was very quickly raised and very quickly disposed of, or was raised and very quickly disposed of, where there was a fear that anybody would then be able to classify themselves as news media for purposes of the waiver, and that would include terrorist groups that could have easier access, therefore, to records. Again, as a control mechanism, you wanted to make these people work as hard as they could. And my response was that I pretty much figured that Al-Qaeda had enough money to pay search and duplication fees at this point. I didn't think this was going to stop them from getting their records. And so we got past that very quickly. I'm uncomfortable, though, with the term blogger to begin with, and increasingly uncomfortable as more and more people are writing. And I've always just really wanted to look at this, both here and in the comparable discussion going on with regard to a federal shield law, as we try to define who a journalist would be for purposes of the reporter's privilege there, the definition of a journalist, and stop using the word blogger. It's so 10 years ago. And I mean, we need to look at the function. We can't define anymore, and that's really, again, it goes back to what is the person's intent? Are they trying to engage in news gathering with the intent for public dissemination?
Kevin, are you suggesting that if bloggers succeed in pressing under this statutory language for recognized status, entitlement to fee waivers or fee limitations as representatives of the news media in the FOIA context, that might carry over to the reporter's privilege debate, whereby bloggers would claim sources just as regular mainstream media folks claim sources, and that might actually dilute that First Amendment issue to the disadvantage of media folks? Is that what it really adds up to? There's tension in that way?
On the advice of my attorney, don't go there. You know, I'll say that we'll say the discussions are comparable, and I will say that in both, we should stop looking at how the person is defined, how the writer is defined, but what they're doing.
Not to be too divisive here or unduly divisive, but does that mean that when it comes to whether bloggers fit within this new definition, some, all, or none at all, that you can't really be looking to the mainstream media folks to be raising or pressing that issue? The bloggers are pretty much left to themselves to press that.
Well, I think the mainstream media have in effect answered that question in the current language of the proposed shield law. They take a very different approach to defining media than is done here. But part of the reason, and I think we have to go back to what was the intent in the FOIA law, the intent of the provision in the FOIA law initially, I believe, was that this one of getting the information to a reasonably broad audience. If someone is gathering the information for himself or for his organization, for profit, whatever, then they should pay the fee. If someone is gathering the information to disseminate it broadly to the public, to put that information out in the public and let the public use this information about government, then they were entitled to the fee waiver. And that's one of the reasons why we thought the initial language on intent made a lot of sense. What are they going to do with the information? Is there a public good involved? And that was where it went, and we hope that at least that was maintained to some degree in the current language.
But in the current language, it no longer has that intent.
It no longer has the intent language in it, that's right.
It could go either way, perhaps, maybe case by case, and we'll have to see bloggers bring
cases.
Well,
if there were a really intelligent guidance from the Attorney General's office, it might help.
But there is a real opportunity here for, if the agencies are so concerned about an increase in the number of requests that are going to come in because of this new definition, there is an opportunity for agencies to begin real proactive disclosure, take advantage of new technology and get that information out there, because bloggers are blogging a lot about the same material. So if there are requested documents out there that can prevent, you know, a deluge of requests coming in from individual requesters, then this is a real opportunity for the agencies to start proactively disclosing records.
Okay, if we're not sure about bloggers, and that remains to be worked out as a matter of regulation, policy development, and litigation.
Well, let me clarify that. I think there is, within the definition that is now in the law, a basis for making that decision. What is the blogger doing with the information when they get it? Are they applying some kind of editorial process to it, going back to the archives case and the definition that was picked up there? Or are they simply doing a rip and read? Are they getting the document and throwing it online without any editing of it, modifying it in any way, without any kind of commentary in any way?
Well, that makes sense. You could have a basic blogger versus a more sophisticated or complex blogger. How about podcasters? I'm holding a document that is produced by the quote-unquote Podcasters Emporium that says U.S. Freedom of Information Act now recognizes podcasters or bloggers. They list podcasters before bloggers. Thank you very much. Do you think the same standard would apply there?
Yes.
Do you think a podcaster, though, would actually add any additional value under the National Security Archive case as opposed to just putting something out? You haven't been asked that podcaster question before,
well,
have you?
What's the difference between a podcaster and whatever he does with the material and a radio commentator or a television commentator? It's simply the medium, that's all. So I think the same standard applies.
Yeah, I mean, you could. I won't arm many friends. You can make the argument that a podcaster is just a blogger who's too lazy to write. He's a great podcast. I'm a guy who subscribes to a million of them. But I mean, he's right. It's radio commentary. It's news. If that's what they're trying to do, if they're trying to take the material create, engage in an editorial function and put it out and disseminate it. Then it should be no different, whether it's written, video podcast, you know, vodcast, or an audio podcast. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, part of what we were saying when we had this discussion at the time and was the media is changing. The way we communicate with each other is changing very rapidly, and we don't even have any idea what it's going to be, you know, 5 or 10 years from now. We shouldn't write a law, however, that restricts in such a way that you can't grow with the changes.
But any other provisions that are of particular media concern? Are you concerned with the new attorney's fees provision being effective immediately?
I think it's a fascinating provision, and there are many contradictions. We did say at the beginning, you know, Pete minimized the effect. We talked about this throughout the process as to how important it would be, and even within the media, there were varying degrees to which it would, you know, be a make or break provision. Smaller newspapers really won't be using the attorney fee provision as much as the larger ones. Well, and even the larger ones now, is, you know, if you believe print to be a dying medium, and I was having a conversation with Andy Alexander earlier today about the finances of print media, and there may not be enough money for the big companies like Andy's, who has gone what now to the United States Court of Appeals to press these very important FOIA requests. So it may be in some regards a very minor provision, but I will point out that this is something that the executive order didn't speak to, and we considered it very major for that regard. When the executive order initially came out, and the administration was arguing that much of what we were trying to do in this bill at the time was unnecessary, this remained very necessary. And we do believe that it is a clear-cut legal change in the end that, it's not a change. In fact, it reinstates prior law. It should be easy to deal with. It's amazing to see where the language itself started and where it finished. I was looking back at some earlier notes that I had, and I think the first discussion I had with James Ho, who worked before Matt did on this bill, this was way back
in Senator Cornyn.
Yeah, for Senator Cornyn, way back in late 2004, I think was when this came from, in early 2005, said, for purposes of this section, a complainant has substantially prevailed if the complainant has obtained some of its requested relief through a judicial or administrative order or an enforceable written agreement at any time after filing a complaint in a United States district court in order to compel production of information under this title, unless the respondent can prove by clear and convincing evidence that such production of information did not occur as a response to the filing of that complaint and was instead the result of other factors unrelated to the court action. There's a lot going on there that didn't end up in the final bill. I mean, if we really broke it down, you know, for something, again, that may or may not have been that important, there was a lot of work to get it to where it is now. There were a lot of factors, such as how much relief would allow you to substantially prevail. Was it some? Was it substantial? Finally, we ended up with just relief. What is covered in the terms of a final action? We had judicial order, enforceable written agreement. We had, at some point, there was an administrative order, and that didn't end up in the final language. Was there any qualification to a settlement type agreement? You know, as we see in the pre-introduction language, you had proof by clear and convincing evidence that the information was not produced in response to the claim. Later on, as it was introduced, it just said that the claim had to be non-frivolous. Senator Kyle wanted some element of bad faith injected, and when he put his hold on the bill in 2007, in the summer of 2007, that was one element that he would have liked to have seen introduced. And now we have the language not insubstantial claim as a qualifier to protect against the government being forced to settle all the time and still give up attorney's fees when it's really more of a business decision type situation. We had the use of the word catalyst, and of course PAYGO coming in and out of whether or not it was in or out of the various versions of the bill. There was a lot of work that went on through this period, but we always saw it as a very integral marker that needed to be there, that the language regarding eligibility for attorney's fees had to be reinstated to pre-Buckhannon levels. Pete did some very good work throughout, and this is why I say he's been consistent in saying that the overall effect may be minimal, because when the Congressional Budget Office came out with estimates that said the average cost of litigating a FOIA lawsuit or administrative appeal is $6,000 per case, Assuming that agencies act on about 1,000 FOIA cases each year, CBO estimates that enacting this legislation would increase direct spending from the judgment fund by $30 million over a 2008 to 2012 period and $63 million over 2008 to 2017. Well, Pete did some reporters' legwork and pretty much proved that the numbers would be substantially smaller. And I think, you know, I think that that's where he's been consistent all along to say that we need this language. We need the precedent, the strong language in the statute to allow people to be eligible. But in reality, the overall effect may not be that much on the government.
Kevin, given all of that and the importance of this provision, is it important to those who work so hard behind the scenes in the legislative process that it be effective immediately?
I think so. I think, you know, again, this is, if you're talking about something that in terms of statutory language needs to be strong, needs to send the message to agencies that they cannot drag their feet just for the purpose of dragging their feet into federal court and beyond, so that, you know, so that Cox Newspapers doesn't have to go through multiple appeals to get very important information regarding what happens to illegal immigrants when they're put back in society, so that Knight Ridder didn't have to go through 2 years of requests and $100,000 worth of litigation to find out, you know, what was going on at the Veterans Administration. I think it's very important. Yeah.
Okay, then in your view and the views of others on the panel here, would you think effective immediately would include being effective as of an attorney's fees decision that was issued yesterday on January 15th, 15 days after the provision took effect? Coincidentally, in a case called National Security Archive versus Department of Defense going back to 1986, the very case that led to the representative of the news media definition that was incorporated into the statutory language. Yesterday, a judge issued a decision in that case denying attorney fees with no mention of the new law and the current legal standard. What do you think of that?
I'm going to parse your word coincidentally. It's sheer statistics that at NSA, that the National Security Archive would be the ones that end up with the first case. They file so many requests. They're so active in litigation. I think that it was almost a given that they'd be the one that found themselves here. But I do think that they will accordingly push and should push using this language for immediate application of the eligibility standard.
So there,
we'll back it up.
So there's a legal question as to whether the new standard, the standard that has existed since December 31st, 2007, should apply to all decisions made by judges on the implementation of the attorney fees provision as of that day, including this one that was issued yesterday.
Well, it's unclear, yeah.
Yeah, but it should be the law of the land, no different than a Supreme Court decision that comes in.
What about the fact that the new language defines substantially prevailed, and that the pre-existing case law, talking about eligibility and entitlement as two basic prongs to defining or interpreting the word substantially prevailed, now is replaced by the new statutory language? Is there an argument, a very good argument perhaps, that the pre-existing case law regarding entitlement that flowed entirely from the 1974 substantially prevailed words and its underlying legislative history no longer is good law, that it's been replaced by Congress entirely? What do you think of that?
I think that the entitlement case law should stand. I think we had this opportunity. There were multiple discussions mainly last summer about whether the entitlement factors needed to be codified in order to create workable language. And I think the prevailing notion was no, that they are case law, they're working fine, and there should be no change in that area. And I don't think there was ever an intent to change those change the existing case law in that area. It's still,
I think there was an effort, at least certainly in the initial drafting, to try to make sure that nothing was done in the language that would have been interpreted as changing. Although I have to say, looking at the language, I think it may even wind up being more liberal.
Yes, yes. See, it's good to have this perspective here. You guys are remembering well the process and what everyone had in mind and what was intended, which might or might not have been memorialized in legislative history. And remember, here we're dealing with a House report on a bill that never was enacted, including bill that had provisions that were changed in many respects, and a Senate report on a bill that was, in effect, enacted in a slightly revised form, but neither of the two really speaking to this. Floor statements, both House and perhaps more importantly Senate, not speaking to this, and a statutory text that now says substantially prevailed means if this. And that same statutory text is what was interpreted by the courts going back to 1974 to mean a whole host of things, establishing entitlement and eligibility. It's entirely possible now that on the face of the statute, notwithstanding what you gentlemen remember, that right there it looks like you substantially prevail if you meet this new standard, and that a FOIA requester would not have to establish entitlement. You would not have to get into those four factors, which would be better for FOIA requesters, or to use Pete's phrase, quote unquote, more liberal than what was intended.
But of course, that could be the case, and we welcome that. But I don't think that it's intended to overrule, you know, and change the entitlement case law if that's applied.
So you're honestly saying it was not intended. You're not sure if that was really memorialized anywhere. So when courts engage in the process of statutory construction and they address this, remembering here we're a law school and we worry about case law development and not just an academic approach but also litigation, how things develop, it's possible the result could come out the other way.
I think so, Dan, and I think it's a good point that there's nothing in here that has the courts looking back through whether this is a request that was made on an individual's behalf or if there was some larger information group that was intended. I think that's a fair enough point. It's pretty straightforward here that if they substantially prevail under this new definition, that they should be entitled to fees.
Yeah. Would you go so far as to suggest, and I know objection, Your Honor, this is a leading question, that in this very decision that was issued yesterday, in this old National Security Archive case that perhaps statistically was likely because they bring so many of them, where a judge not only didn't apply the new standard at all, but actually denied fees based upon the legislative history and case law under the old standard that arguably would no longer apply, that the result would be entirely different. And I mention that because in this case, this decision that was issued yesterday, it's undisputed in the record of the case, according to a footnote 4, I think, of the decision, that the parties concede what's called eligibility. And if an entitlement doesn't apply, then that takes care of that.
Well, I mean, I'll tell you, obviously, like I said, I would welcome that interpretation. I think it is, on paper, a good interpretation, a valid interpretation. I'm just saying honestly, even for a lawyer, honestly, that we really never considered it that way. We were looking at the eligibility portion throughout. At least that was my recollection.
So if there were a government litigator in the audience, and I won't out him or her necessarily, would be interested in this issue and might be briefing the other side of it, that person could fairly cite your recollection at this forum here. Whether that would be given any weight as a matter of law is another matter.
None whatsoever, frankly, but I'm just pulling out my recollections of our discussions, and it never really came up.
Kevin is being both honest and unweighty at the same time in that respect.
Pretty much. Okay.
How about any other provision, including some that I might have put further down the list? No offense to Pete, because you've already said I put the report way down too low, making that number 7. How about the tracking of requests? That's pretty significant, isn't it?
Oh, yes. I think anybody that was talking about earlier, tracking obviously gives people a way to know where their request is and whether they really have an issue with the agency, I think. It's a fairly simple process. Yeah, I think you raised the question earlier, is it all that much different than what goes back to the eFOIA Act of 1996? And what's intended or what is hoped to be accomplished is not any different. I think this puts it in a much more specific sense and that makes it where the eFOIA provisions provided a method to go ahead
and an authorization to go ahead, but it didn't say you had to have it in place by a certain time. This creates a mandate.
I was just recounting the fact that I gather from my former agency, the Department of Justice, that it is suggesting, including publicly, that all of the provisions in that section of the bill are already being taken care of under existing practice. And there's at least that one provision that requires agencies to indicate the estimated date on which the agency will respond to the request. That is something that is brand new, and I imagine you're going to think it's valuable from your perspective as well.
Oh, I think it's very much so. That they ought to be able to at least give some estimate when they're going to have a request. You can begin to pay attention to the tracking process if you haven't gotten a request. And they're going to need to have that information and to work from that to meet the deadlines.
Lauren and Kevin, how about shifting over to the time limit procedures? And I could tell in Lauren's eye that you were focusing on that.
Yeah.
Specifically, the fact that the deadline calculation or the deadline itself, the time period, can be told. And you see how there's ambiguity there as to exactly how it can be told and for how long. What do you think of all of that?
Well, again, and I've got to credit Pete for coming up, for pointing this out yesterday. This is another area where Senator Kyle was pointing to this as a particular way to refocus the requester, to send it back to them and have them parse out exactly what their request was, come back ideally with a smaller request, and again come back time and time again. And my fear is that will be something that, well, I think it'll be wide open for litigation on how the tolling takes place.
Let me just add, though, that in the various discussions we had with staff on this, as we were discussing with the senators, Senator Kyle's staff, Senator Leahy's staff, Senator Cornyn's staff, the proposed changes that Senator Kyle had, the discussion always went to the fact that the agency would make one request, would go back one time. And it would not be multiple, because we raised the question of, you know, a concern about their coming back again and again and again and again.
And as long as we can define what single request is, I think we'll be fine. But that may be where we try and figure out what that is, a single request to parse down. And then does that come with subparts, which lawyers are so famous for?
Especially when you get to the fee part of that.
Well, that's interesting, Dan, because the fee issue never came up again in the discussions.
Really?
That's right.
Because I would imagine that a big part of the, we're talking about letters of inquiry that agencies send back to the requester. The requester comes in on day one. The clock starts running when it's received by the proper part of the agency. So day one, day two, second working day, and so forth. Then the agency might send a letter back to the requester inquiring about one thing or another. It could be about interpreting the scope of the request, a reasonable question under some circumstances. Or it could be saying, hey, this is the situation with respect to fees. We think it's going to be this. What say you? Are you willing to commit beyond what the regulations say you automatically commit to? Dialogue back and forth like that. Agencies might say, well, you know, we might have to send a lot of letters out to requesters, and every time we send out a new letter, that could toll that deadline again, and therefore we won't be in breach of that deadline, and therefore we won't have a penalty of no duplication fee or no search fee. So agencies could even actually say, because we're sending a fee letter out to inquire about fees, we're going to be able to charge fees because we sent the letter out about fees. See how it becomes almost tautological that way.
Processing as well, yeah. Same sort of questions
but,
for that.
But at least from the discussion purposes, and it may have been because a lot of people haven't been involved in sending those letters that we're having the discussions, was that there ought to be one communication from the agency out to the requester that could control the process let's get straightened out what you're asking for, what you're willing to pay, so let's get it done. Stop it one time and then go forward.
So when the government litigator cites Kevin in the brief regarding the attorney fee issue as to whether there's something that is more than just overturning Buchanan involved there, in the other type of case, someone can cite you and say, well, wait a minute, it should be clear, only one request, singular, in the same sort of way.
I've got a notoriously governmental memory.
Okay. How about we open it up to questions from the audience to try to stay really close on time.
Okay.
Here we have someone who we already know is here from a federal agency, from the Department of State in particular.
Well, regarding the date of estimate, I wondered how that could be related to...
Can you try to aim more for the mic?
Oh, how can that be related to Section 11, Report on Personnel Policies, related to FOIA specifically, provide greater encouragement to all federal employees to fulfill their duties? Say, for instance, an agency FOIA office depends on other parts of the agency to help find documents, which aren't held to accountability. What can be done to increase levels of accountability with other agency employees who aren't directly in the FOIA office? And secondly, on the list of priorities, I'm not sure if I missed it, but I didn't see anything regarding increasing numbers of people working, and I actually think there would be less questions of fees and litigation if we had the staff to, and all of the agencies process these, and I think that's the bottom line and actually the most important point.
And yeah, and of course getting, we have never, never quarreled with that. Every time we revisit what's really wrong with the Freedom of Information Act, it is that it is not a priority in government. It is not a financial priority. It's not a personnel priority, you know, at the highest levels, at least not to the extent it should be. And so we've always agreed with that. That's really where the fix needs to occur. And I think that is what the quiet push is with regard to the first part of your question. I do understand. I don't want you to think that we are ignoring the pleas that, you know, what happens if it goes outside FOIA, outside the FOIA officer to other parts of the agency and they're not as responsive. When I say, well, unfortunately, the problem is now sort of incumbent on the FOIA office to continue to push. But we, part of the overall thrust, though, is to make FOIA a priority. And we are looking at ways to make sure that it is not just part of the administrative function of the agency, but, you know, that it's its own function, has its own budget, has its own qualifications, again, for personnel advancement and salary advancement and things. And this was one way that, you know, you're going to certainly feel the burden, but we hope that the payoff in the long run is seen. That's the only answer I can give. It's not going to be one you want to hear right now. I understand that, but that was sort of the part of the idea behind all of this that plays into this section of the bill.
And not to be unduly negative, but there's nothing in this bill or in this new law that will provide additional funds to agencies.
No.
As a matter of fact, quite the contrary with respect to the agency appropriations being tapped for attorney's fees, not to penalize agencies or not even to encourage them to do better and not to have to pay attorney's fees, but simply because of that House PAYGO complication, just a very technical matter. If you can't even get money right away for the archive, the National Archives, which for the past 16 days has had this statutory mandate to have this office up and running, providing the service, then it's even harder to get money government-wide.
In a sense, the one thing that has been done in the past couple of years that might work toward that goal is the creating of the chief FOIA officer at a high enough level within any agency that they might actually be able to talk to the secretary or the agency head once in a while and might be able to have some kind of an influence on the budget process.
As a matter of fact, let me pick up on that one point. A little known aspect of Executive Order 13392 is that chief FOIA officer, in one little part of the executive order, does have the opportunity, if not the obligation, to recommend need for additional funding to the head of the agency. All through that executive order, the word appropriate is used left and right, and there are references that caveat things by saying, well, within existing funding, within funding that is available, and so forth. But there is that one little part there. And now that the chief FOIA officer position has been codified by law and will be permanent beyond the tenure of that executive order and the president who issued it, maybe that will be a mechanism that can work that way. If you combine that part of the executive order with the statutory codification of the provision, that's one little ray of hope right there. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, hi, Elaine Middleman. And you talk about, I'm an attorney, you talk about attorney's fees, reminding me of a case I had a long time ago. When I was appointed by the district court in D.C. under the civil pro bono panel to represent a prisoner in a Freedom of Information Act case, and the government, U.S. Attorney's Office, dragged it out so long that the guy died. I got a phone call from the law clerk, excuse me, but your client is now dead. And anyway, I went up on appeal and went back down again, and I did get attorney's fees, which the U.S. Attorney's Office challenged, but Judge Oberdorfer wrote a really nice opinion, which I've got to share with anybody, and he put in there, the bulk of the seven-year litigative effort involved a three-page document. So I did get attorney's fees, but I mean, it was an outrageous, obviously, situation.
And that's why I say that that was a particularly important provision, at least from where I'm standing, is that the money itself is one thing. But under the FOIA, even with the amendments that have been passed, the only remedy right now is still to file suit. And so if there is some sort of penalty for an agency that is clearly just dragging their feet, waiting for the eve of a dispositive motion to do a document dump and to hand over whatever they you know, may or may not feel that they need to, that's something that may change behaviors, and that's the most tangible thing that I think we can see immediately.
Especially, I think it was important to note that when we were looking at this provision, we always saw it working in concert with an Office of Government Information Service, that you couldn't, in effect, have one change without the other, that some people were definitely going to need the front-end help, but that the back-end help was just as important, even if they never used it. The fact that it was there was very important to move things through the process, and you needed to have both in a final bill, or else it wasn't going to work.
One more question right here. From an earlier panelist.
Oh, no, not her.
This issue about the time limits and, you know, one request from the agency, I mean, which I, you know, when this was kind of coming into the bill, I didn't think that it should be added, and I still don't. I don't. But the Justice Department and the agencies felt strongly they needed the ability to go back to the requester. That's probably reasonable. But, you know, at some point, we assume the agencies are not going to play games with every FOIA request. I mean, they have to issue regulations. The vast majority of people who are handling FOIA requests are trying to do the right thing. If they spend a lot of time, you know, back and forth with requesters about asking for more information, they're going to waste a lot of time and they're not going to accomplish anything. So they're going to end up looking bad at the other end anyway. And so hopefully the agencies will do the right thing, and this is somewhere where OIP guidance would be helpful. We'll do the right thing, and in the cases where maybe there is some game playing going on, it'll be easy to expose it. So I just wanted to say, you know, while I don't think that this is something great in the law and I'm not happy about it, I mean, realistically, we shouldn't be looking at this all as an effort to discourage FOIA requests from getting processed, and I'm sure that most agency personnel don't look at it that way.
So you will trust but verify. Is that a fair summary? Trust that agencies will implement in a reasonable way, but double-check it very carefully, perhaps by using speech statistical analysis, and then go to Congress if necessary, if it's not working out that way. Well, that's a nice segue to our next panel, the Speaker of Congress. But let me thank first